Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Paul Glader is a professor of journalism and entrepreneurship at the King's College in New York City, where he also directs the McCandlish Phillips Journalism Institute. He serves as executive director and board member ex officio of the Media Project. He's a USD alum, and his upcoming lecture at Farber Hall is called The Power of Great Groups. That's coming up tonight at 7 p.m. Paul Glader, welcome to Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Lori. Great to be here.
Did I get all that right?
I think you did.
There's a lot. There's a lot in there. Let's talk about this this topic at first. You're back in South Dakota after being away for a while, I'm assuming. Why talk about great groups?
Yeah. I was a political science major at USD, and when they asked me to give a talk, I decided to start thinking about what were the classes that impacted me the most, what were the books that impacted me the most, and I realized there was a book in a class on leadership by a guy named Warren Bennis that outlined this idea of great groups and how they were starting in the 90s. The book came out, and it was how great groups were starting to change our lives and change our corporate cultures and et cetera. And I also was reflecting on, man, that time in the 90s when I was a student at USD, nobody had a cell phone. There was no such thing really as Wi-Fi. Hardly any students had laptops. And so in the last, 15 years, all that has changed. And I think this topic actually gets into a bit of how and why that's changed and maybe forces us to think about how we might apply some of that thinking to our situations.
So essentially, you're taking a book that you read that came out at about the time you were here.
Yeah.
And fast-forwarding it and sort of evaluating how it applies to us now and how it's changed over the past 15 years or so.
Yeah, his thesis in the book is that we often go through life thinking great people, great men, the great man theory of history from Thomas Carlyle, the Scottish philosopher, or even Nietzsche, the Uberman, you know, that it's great men, which is kind of sexist to think about. But let's say great men or women change history and accomplish things. And he starts to say, no, actually, if we look carefully, it's great groups that have a lot more power. Mm-hmm. And he gives six case studies in the book. Disney Company or Walt Disney, Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works division that made the SR-71 Blackbird and other airplanes during and after World War II, the Park Labs from Xerox, which actually led to Apple, and I use Apple as an example of this. And so we walked through some of those, and then I like to pivot and think about then, what does this mean for us? What does it mean for citizens? What does it mean for people in South Dakota? And the lectures named after my mentor, Bill, one of my mentors, Bill, the late Bill Farber, we called him Doc. And so I kind of try to analyze Doc's life a bit and how he applied this theory and how we might do the same.
Is this a cultural thing when you talk about individual versus a group? I think Eastern Western culture. Do you see that as the rise of the individual or the import of the individual as being sort of a Western thing or an American construct?
Well, that's interesting to think about. Yeah, I mean, I think we do have more individualism perhaps in the U.S., but it's fascinating to look at. Okay, the last 15 years we've seen the top five most valuable companies on our stock market have changed from a mix of oil companies and retail companies to five tech companies, Facebook, or Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Amazon, I believe, are the five. And what happened with those companies, these very young companies? And what's interesting is a lot of them involve immigrants who came to study at like Stanford University typically, and they somehow met other students. And yes, they were good with technology, but they actually needed the interplay of other people, other ideas to come up with their business idea to push it forward, to make it happen. And so to that question on East-West idea, I gave the same a version of this lecture in Hong Kong a few months ago. And you look at China. China's trying to capture the magic of Silicon Valley in great groups. So we see business incubators happening all over China. We see, and Europe and everywhere else, these co-working spaces, attempts at universities to get business students and tech students and journalism students to talk to each other, to create new companies. So what happened organically in Silicon Valley and other parts of the U.S. is kind of now becoming a huge global phenomenon. Everybody's trying to capture it. And The New York Times had a piece on China. One city in China, I believe, had launched 12,000 startups, it claimed. But they call it venture communism. Can we do it from the top down, or can you just sort of set the table, invite people, and hope a great group forms? That's what's not really clear. It's a little more wild than that. It's a little, you can create atmosphere, perhaps, but great groups, not all groups that come together accomplish world-beating things, right? I mean, maybe people come together in a neighborhood and create a community garden, and you have, that's a great group too. Because one of his theories is great groups give us some joy, right? Mm-hmm. When we, for some people anyways, maybe that kind of structure gives us more joy than working in a really hierarchical situation or working totally alone as a total individual.
Mm-hmm. Can it be recreated? Are you seeing certain patterns or structures that you can be intentional? If you're already working in a group, for example, and you said, you know, we're stagnant, you know, people aren't happy, I want to create a better group. Can you start from a place of sort of dysfunction and start molding it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think Bennis says that that's where leadership comes in, because how do great groups form? It's one or two people sort of making them happen. And so if you look at Steve Jobs, he seemed to create several great groups over time at companies. And so I was thinking of South Dakota, what are great groups here? And things, you might get great groups coming out of things like Boys State or Girls State, or something I heard of recently of Montana has a Leadership Montana. And then I saw South Dakota has one too. And I actually saw, I knew one or two people involved in it. Think about sports teams, teams like, Stephen Curry's team over there, Golden State Warriors, or I just saw the USD women won.
Right.
Often when the joy when you're on a team that comes together, gels, and does something awesome, it's an incomparable joy. And so can we do the same thing in our churches, in our communities, in our universities? And I do think it's possible, but it takes the right people to make it happen. Both the right people coming together, and the right leaders sort of setting the table, the institution that is allowing for the space for that to happen as well.
What are some of the roadblocks? What are the things to not do if you're looking at creating that space to help a group really thrive?
This would be me speculating, because as I think back on the book, I don't know that he dwells too much on that, the converse of that. But, you know, as I think about it, it would be giving people space is how you create it. So maybe removing freedom, autonomy, or creativity from the equation, not allowing people to propose ideas. Like, okay, any institution or any company or organization, I would think, should somehow be open to ideas from big and small. Mm-hmm. And vetting those ideas. And if you are part of one that is just totally not open and is dictatorial, led by one person, then that doesn't seem to allow for the oxygen of people or of ideas for people to thrive. I think this is connected to human flourishing. How do we help other people flourish? How do we help our cities flourish? So, you know, when you go around the U.S. and you see cities that are flourishing and those that aren't, I think the ones that are flourishing seem to be empowering their people somehow, with action, with ideas, with frankly creating lots of little great groups.
Right. Give me some. Can you think, as you were reading this book, as you were preparing for your lecture tonight? And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Paul Glader. He's a professor of journalism and entrepreneurship at the King's College. He's a USD alum. He's back in Vermilion tonight for a lecture on the power of great groups. And I'm wondering if, as you did your preparation and have spent some time in thought about this, if stories from your own life and experiences you've had in the workforce or in education come to mind, and you've thought, well, that was what that lightning was in the bottle then, and you recognized it.
Yeah, no, I've learned, actually this book has caused me over the last 15, 16 years to look for great groups, to try to recognize when I am part of one, but to look for leaders to be part of their team. If I'm leading a team, to try to create a dynamic where we might have a great group. So yeah, I counted eight times, and I think I've been part of something that felt like it. Yeah. And you know, they're simple or large. One simple one was actually when I was editing the student newspaper here, the Volant, which I just stopped in to say hello to today. And I remember as sports editor, we decided I had to recruit people, really good talent. And the one thing we did was instead of waiting to cover the sports games from USD several days after they happened and having them run in the paper a week later, we decided let's start covering them the same day, turn in a story, put them online, because we wanted to beat, frankly, all the other media in the state. And it started, lots of little things we started doing like that started to matter. And the other sports editors would say, you know, took notice. And when the student journalism awards in the whole region, you know, Minnesota, Iowa, all the big schools, Big Ten schools, with the big school papers that published every day and had bigger staffs than us, we had the awards. And we, you know, I was so honored that our sports columnists took first, second, third, and we won for features. We won in every single category. It was almost embarrassing how many awards we swept because we were motivated and we were working together. And so that was one example where I take joy in, frankly. I'd say the other one, right now I'm involved with this group, The Media Project, where we do training of journalists around the world, including in the Global South, and we want to see journalism culture thrive. We want to see press freedom, religious freedom, freedom of all kinds like that take root in these places. And so that's, I think we're doing some great work, and I'm working with really great people from different parts of the world, so I get to experience that joy again.
Now, I love to geek out on journalism culture, so let's pivot a little bit and talk about that and the Media Project and what some of those, I mean, how does that work, and what kind of work are you doing on a daily basis with that?
Yeah, so we have journalists, working journalists who are editors and reporters, broadcast TV all around the world, and we stay in touch with them over social media, regular email newsletters. We do trips and training at universities. In places like Indonesia and Uganda and Eastern Europe and Latin America. And so I send specialists on topics like business reporters, video documentarians to schools like in Uganda where they have a need to, for example, the Norwegians gave millions of dollars worth of great video equipment to the school in Uganda. So one of my board members was a producer for Peter Jennings at ABC. And so she went over and taught for a week on how to use the equipment and to tell stories. And so that, I think that's going to make a big change for that university. And then we met with working journalists there as well. We bring some of them to the U.S. every year for a program on leadership and best skills training at the Poynter Institute in Florida.
Sure.
So that's how we do it.
When some of the places that you've listed, I don't necessarily think of a strong freedom of the press there. Is that you're starting from sort of scratch with some of these reporters who are doing work where they could get in a lot more trouble than we can in South Dakota doing journalism?
Yeah, no, a lot of them are really smart and talented and feel the burdens of working in a place that doesn't have the kind of freedoms. Interestingly, they have sometimes, like in Ethiopia, they have more religious freedom, but less press freedom. Or they have a lot of religious people. Religion is actually growing in all lots of the world. It's getting more important, not less important to folks. And we say, you know, religious freedom, press freedom actually go together. And you have a more stable democracy when you create space for people to be free and to speak freely, to think freely, to believe freely. I think we just try to encourage them in the situation in which they are working. Mm-hmm. And good journalism begets more good journalism. And ethics and integrity for journalists helps you stand up to governments that may be repressive. And democracy doesn't happen overnight. It moves in waves. Mm-hmm. Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington talks a lot about that it's democracy moves in waves. It might go two steps forward, three steps back, three steps forward, two steps back. When you have an event like 9/11, lots of the world wants to become a democracy and says it is, but then in practice it starts to slide back. We're at risk of that probably in our own countries, country and in advanced democracies. Sometimes you see little things like, okay, technology's caused new questions here. Do we that we have to wrestle with. So we, as citizens, as journalists, we have to constantly be vigilant to maintain our freedoms. And so, you know, yeah, there some of our friends who are journalists in different parts of the world may be in different climates and situations, but they can still relate to us if we speak in a way and encourage each other in a way of you know, not just to follow the American model, but to follow good journalism principles universally and in their own context.
Sure. One more question just for fun. What did you learn in your education in South Dakota that you took with you and you remember every day in New York when you do your work? Put you on the spot there.
Doc Farber, I mean, he lived across from this campus. He spent 70 years at this school, mentored Rhodes Scholars, CEOs, governors, senators, and he had time for students. And he said, had a lot of great quotes, like, egads, think of the possibilities, he would often say. And so I think of Doc probably every day, and I think of his role wasn't just a teacher, but it was a mentor. And so make time for students, make time for people the way he did, you know, because mm-hmm. again, back to great groups, like people are what cause change, not always institutions. It's the people in the institutions and leading the institutions.
Paul Glader will be at USD tonight. You can see him at 7 o'clock at Farber Hall. The lecture is called The Power of Great Groups. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back.
Thanks, Lori. Good to meet you.